You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Opioid addiction has become a public health crisis. In fact, just yesterday, the Wisconsin Senate gave final approval to 9 bills aimed at combating that problem. And Governor Walker is saying that he looks forward to signing them.
Making the situation worse, there are new variants of synthetic opioids, which have public health officials scrambling to figure out what they are and just how lethal they are. Since 2012, synthetically manufactured opioids with names like Furanil, fentanyl, and others have played a role in rising overdose deaths here in Wisconsin.
Because some of these drugs have no equivalents among known prescription opioids, public health officials and law enforcement often can't detect them in toxicology tests.
WPR's Scott Gordon is with us now. He's associate editor of WisContext.org, where he's been following the story. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
When we think of this opioid drug problem, I think in my head there's heroin, right, the illegal stuff you inject, and then there's prescription painkillers, one or two kinds of those. As you write, it's way more complicated than that.
Right. It tends to be more of a mix. I mean, just by nature, the supply of something illicit is going to be kind of erratic, and it's going to be a bit impure. And of course, one of the big problems with fentanyl is that it's sort of cut into the heroin supply. And so people will often end up using this kind of unknowingly or unwittingly.
Yeah, talk about the diversity of, you write about synthetic opioids. There are new kinds appearing that that authorities are having a hard time keeping track of.
Right. And some aren't exactly new. Fentanyl and carfentanil are both things that are kind of, they're known quantities, and they've been out there and had some, legitimate use in various contexts for a while. But some of the opioids out there are kind of these novel variations on the chemical structure of fentanyl. And those become a little bit more difficult for people to track if you're, doing toxicology testing after an overdose death, because people don't necessarily know what exactly they're looking for, if it's something that hasn't been around and hasn't really been well documented.
And where are these synthetic opioids coming from? Are we seeing labs like meth labs around the country, around the world? But for these opioids?
Basically, officials in the United States have said that a lot of it is being manufactured in China. But really, who knows? And that's something where China has said that it would crack down on some of these things. But it's not clear how effective that is. And it's not clear if these things are coming from elsewhere either.
This poses an extra hazard to the users, it sounds like, because with these different types of opioids, the dosage, the strength can really vary from one supply to the next, maybe one dose to the next.
Right. It's kind of unknown how potent some of these things will be if they're not things that have been sort of developed and controlled in a laboratory setting or in a setting where there's some kind of documentation or certification going on. And, clearly the people making these novel opioids are good chemists, and they're, creating these chemicals to try and circumvent the laws that, prohibit certain substances specifically. But it does, you're right, it does introduce a whole other aspect of unpredictability into the situation.
I know sometimes when we're talking about drugs and we say numbers like 10 times as powerful or 100 times as powerful, that can be a bit vague. But it sounds like taking a dose of one and a dose of a different thing the next day, it can be orders of magnitude more powerful.
Right. And as I was saying earlier, often these things tend to get mixed together, and that also creates another challenge for people investigating these deaths, which you might have a fairly large quantity in your system of a more conventional, better known drug like heroin, but a much more small quantity of something much more powerful, such as, carfentanil or one of these other synthetic opioids. And it's not really clear just yet that these synthetic opioids are having a huge impact in Wisconsin. There have been a few deaths related to carfentanil and to fentanyl and to some of the more novel ones. But again, it's kind of this wide unknown.
And let's talk about that unknown. You write a lot about the difficulties in tracking these things that, say, a medical examiner and others can have. What kind of problems do we have with even just getting reliable data about how much of the different types of opioids we're seeing?
Well, to start with, when a lab like the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene, which I focus on in a couple of my stories, is doing toxicology testing on an overdose victim, testing their blood or urine or vitreous fluid, they kind of will go in knowing mostly what they're looking for, and that will inform the testing approach. And if you don't know exactly what you're looking for and you know what ballpark you're kind of in, you can do that, but that takes generally some expensive instrumentation that the lab doesn't necessarily have.
And, yeah, talk about equipment. Are we equipped as a state, as county and local governments to try to test for these things and watch for them?
Well, I would say no. And the state and, you know, county coroners and medical examiners can access some of that testing by outsourcing it to private labs. But, of course, that's expensive. And, you know, in some cases, people have some discretion as to whether they, you know, go for that kind of testing.
Is this, do we only test these various fluids in the case of an overdose death, or do we also test them in non-fatal overdoses?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really look into non-fatal overdoses in my story, but I know that's something that the state and the CDC are trying to get more information on as well.
And talk about the people doing this testing. When there's an overdose death in the county, who's in charge of doing that, and what kind of training do they have?
Well, a lot of smaller counties in Wisconsin don't have, you know, a medical examiner who's an actual doctor. Most counties in Wisconsin have an elected coroner. In some cases, that person works part-time as the coroner. So in a lot of cases, they'll be outsourcing a lot of their work on autopsies and testing to a larger county like Dane County or Fond du Lac County, for example, and or to state labs like the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene and to various private labs.
Scott Gordon is with us from WisConText. We're looking at opioids in Wisconsin, different kinds, more variety of opioids than you might think, and very difficult to track some of them, to get good data on what is out there, what's causing overdose deaths. And let's talk about that a little bit more, Scott. In addition to the technology and the science of detecting a particular kind of drug, how about how it gets recorded so we have usable data from county to county and across the state?
Right. So when someone dies of an overdose, there's obviously a death certificate. There's generally a, you know, coroner's report and a you know, some level of law enforcement investigation and so forth. So there is documentation, but there isn't necessarily a really hard and fast standardized way in which people go through and document every single drug that might be involved. So when these things are all kind of aggregated at the state level, you might not necessarily always get a clear picture of, you know, here's how many overdose deaths involve heroin, here's how many overdose deaths involve carfentanil, and here's how many involved U47700, which is this synthetic thing that's out there. And so they're using kind of this code called the ICD-10 that we'll break down causes and contributing factors of a death into these various categories. And in some cases, a drug kind of will have its own category that indicates it specifically, like heroin. But in the case of other drugs, there is more of a broad category. Like, just there's one that's just basically for synthetic opioids other than methadone. So, you know, all the things involving fentanyl and this array of kind of substances that are similar to it will kind of all be lumped into one category. So, and there's some work going on about this at the state level and at the CDC level to break it down in a more specific way, but that's going to be starting with data from 2016. So if you want to kind of go back and look over the past 5 or 10 years and get some kind of idea of how these things have entered the mix and how they've had an impact on a broader statewide level, you're going to have a really hard time doing that.
And that's drilling down pretty fine there. Even at a wider level, if I understand it right, an overdose might be classified as an accidental poisoning, a suicide, or even a homicide, depending on the situation, depending on which medical examiner or whoever is entering this.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one thing that one of the folks I talked to at the State Department of Health Services talked about is that it is sometimes genuinely hard to understand the intentionality behind a death, you know, whether someone meant to die by suicide or whether someone overdosed unintentionally, you know, or whether it technically qualifies as a homicide because someone was, you know, unwittingly sold something that was too powerful.
How important is getting good data? I mean, it sounds like it might just be bureaucratic record keeping, but how important is it to get better, solid data in an effort to treat this problem?
Well, I mean, as a reporter, I kind of obviously take it as a given that more data is important. But I think at the public policy level, the argument for this is that the better people understand the circumstances of overdose, the better people understand the various, you know, chemicals that are in the mix here, then the better we can craft policies that sort of address these issues and, you know, ultimately prevents the, you know, use of dangerous substances, at least in more cases.
One more complicating factor I wanted to ask about, you mentioned multiple types of drugs, like maybe heroin and a little bit of synthetic opioid in the mix. What about mixing those with alcohol, which I understand is part of the story? Do we have ways to classify opioids and other substances involved in the same overdose?
Yeah, I mean, there's a way to kind of classify the various contributing factors in a death. I think one of the big issues is that if with a code thing like the ICD-10, which I mentioned, you know, it's kind of like the DSM, right, where it's updated over time. And if a new thing comes on the scene, it's not going to adapt overnight to that new information. And so, you know, in a lot of senses, people are kind of constantly playing catch up.
So what you've been pursuing this opioid story in a lot of different angles. Where are you going next with it?
Well, one thing that I'm going to be looking at next is kind of in light of the fact that there have been some more recent deaths in Wisconsin involving chemicals like carfentanil. I'm going to kind of look more into how state and local officials in Wisconsin are dealing with the threat of law enforcement and EMS workers and even lab technicians being exposed to some of this stuff, because there are opioids out there that can be transmitted transdermally or can be really powerful when inhaled in even really small amounts. So that obviously creates a lot of danger for people who, not just for people who are intentionally using them, but for people who encounter them in the field as part of their jobs. So, and this has been known for a while in kind of the law enforcement community and among EMS workers, but interested to see how people in Wisconsin respond to that problem.
And we'll want to talk with you about that. I wanted to ask a question about how we in the media talk about this opioid problem. I think you had shared with us internally some guidelines from NPR. When I know in our talking about this, we've used the word epidemic when we've talked about opioid. Is that something that you steer clear of, or do you think it's an appropriate word to use?
Well, I think that's appropriate in this case, just given the amount of, you know, of damage that's been done. But of course, I think that in media and in American culture, there, you know, has historically been a tendency toward a bit of hysteria surrounding drugs. So I think it's important to steer clear of that. But, you know, also don't discount the problem when it's really hurting people. And, you know, when it's a legitimate public health problem. One guide that I would look to for anyone either consuming or writing news about this is the On the Media Breaking News Handbook of Drug Edition, which is something that they recently published. And it's part of a kind of a running series they're doing of how to kind of consume news stories about breaking issues that I think is really fantastic and really clarifying.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks as always.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Scott Gordon. He's associate editor of wiscontext.org. He joined us to talk about synthetic opioids that are a factor in a rising number of opioid drug overdose deaths in Wisconsin. You can find a link to his WisContext piece on the topic over at the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest divides his time between the U.S. and Sweden. After paying taxes in both countries and looking at what that money buys, he'd rather pay taxes in Sweden, he says, even if the rate's a little higher there.
Thomas Hemmerlein is a native of Portage and was a longtime professor at UW-Madison. He's been teaching in Sweden since 2004 and is at work on the book Falling in Love with Sweden, One Mistake at a Time. And you can find his piece about taxes up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. Thomas joins us in studio. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Thomas, you split your time between Sweden and the United States, and you wrote about how a visit to the Apostle Islands, the islands at the tippy top of Wisconsin, it got you thinking about what we get for our taxes here in this country. Can you tell me a little bit about that visit and what you started thinking about in terms of accessibility for families and all that stuff?
Sure. We get to the end of Wisconsin, you get to the Apostle Islands, it's a national park, and there's one boat a day, and it can cost a family over $100 to take their family out. I live in Stockholm. We have a 23,000 island archipelago. I see public radio, public TV trip is going to Stockholm in a month or so, and you'll be going out to those islands. And there it costs $10 or $15 to get out to these islands. My wife and I had a full-day boat trip in the islands for about $25. So the Swedes have developed systems to give access to these areas, and we have things that we don't get access to because we expect the public to pay their way out there rather than the Park Service to provide it.
Now, here in the United States, Scandinavian countries have a reputation for a high rate of taxation, or at least a higher rate of taxation. Is that fair?
Well, my experience when I went to Stockholm, I mean, the book is called One Mistake at a Time, right? And one of the mistakes was I thought, oh, 56% tax. How can you possibly survive in a country where people take more than half your income in income tax? Then we started paying income tax, and it turned out we were only paying in the low 30%. Here I pay 23%, so I pay more, but not as much. And then I don't pay any property tax. Wisconsin farmers, you hearing that? No property tax. Read my lips. So that was a surprise to me. And then, of course, when I go out to buy something here in Wisconsin, I pay $10, and then they say, and that will be $10.53. When I buy something in Sweden for 100 kroner, it's 100 kroner. You make the deal on the price. Now, when you look at the receipt, you will discover that you've paid 25% sales tax on that. Oh my gosh, that sounds terribly high, doesn't it? In Wisconsin, we pay almost 25% sales tax on our gasoline. But when you go in and buy $20 worth of gas, they don't say, oh, and then that will be $5 for the taxes. So the Swedes have embedded this, as we do in gas tax, and so you don't think about paying tax. You think about buying gasoline. You think about buying a product. So things are expensive in Sweden because they carry that tax burden, but it doesn't hurt. And like that no property tax bill, that's the one that always hurts me right before Christmas. I think I'm just a little ahead, and bang, I'm not.
Right, and you have a lot of thoughts about the way that we report our taxes and all the rest of it. You say in a way the U.S. system is designed to make you feel kind of miserable. And one aspect of that, you say the U.S. tax system, generally, if they want to incentivize something or give you a break, you get a tax deduction or a tax credit, let's say. And in Sweden, you say generally what you get is cash.
Money, when you need it. So if you have a child here, you get a tax deduction, right? You have a child in Sweden, you get a check every month. So you can use the money to buy the shoes to take care of the kids. The more kids you have, up to a certain, well, the more kids you have, you keep getting an increase in the amount. I've got my apartment remodeled. And was when the economy was down, and they basically were trying to employ workers to fix people's apartments and build things up. And when I got the bill, it said 50,000 kroner to be paid for by the IRS. And I said, fine, when do I write you the check for the 50,000? Oh, no. And they said the IRS sends it to us.
And we just got through with tax season here in Wisconsin as well. People filling out their tax forms, some people hiring accountants or someone to complete their taxes. And it surprised me to hear that in Sweden, you say the tax forms come to you and they're already filled out. How can that be?
It surprised me, too. My tax form in Sweden is 4 pages long. And the one here we fill out is 32 pages long, and it takes us weeks to gather all that information and fill it out, which is a tax on the taxpayer. Furthermore, we spend $32 billion a year paying tax preparers to help us pay our taxes. So that's a tax I can't get out of, and that we can't get out of. So it's very efficient. The government needs to collect this money for collective goods, but they make it easy for the taxpayer to pay.
Now, I want to mention something that David Brooks wrote about in the New York Times. He said that if Americans paid European-style high taxes, he says it would weaken the ability of members of the middle class to make choices about their own lives. What do you say to that argument? Is Brooks onto something?
Well, that was the most amazing thing in my experience. I started to discover that when you pay higher taxes, you're not burning up the money. You're buying collective goods. And when you buy those collective goods all together, then they're available to everybody. So, in Sweden, college is paid for everyone. College students get to choose where they want to go, not on the basis of how wealthy their parents are, but what school they want to go to. They don't have to work as much while they're going to school because they get a stipend from the state. As a professor, I'm delighted that my students aren't flipping hamburgers, that they can go to the library. And so they get that choice, that opportunity. I live in Lodi, where we have low taxes in America, some of the lowest in the world on a GDP basis. I'm free. I have a lot of freedom. I'm free to come to Madison any way I want, as long as it's in a private automobile with me driving. There's no train connection. There's no bus connection. Any city near Stockholm Village, the size of Lodi, with the railroad tracks to it, would have 2 to 3 trains an hour and bus service as well. So I have much more freedom of choice, given that we have spent that money in Sweden for the collective goods.
Now, someone who is looking at this with a critical eye could say, yes, but some people may not be able to afford this higher rate of taxation, even though you say it isn't as high as we think it is, only high, especially high for the top earners. But isn't it also true that some of these taxes are regressive and they fall more heavily on lower income people?
That's right. The problem with the sales tax is that it is very regressive. But the good thing about Sweden is that you have a very tight income distribution. Professors don't make a lot more than cab drivers, but cab drivers are pretty well paid. And so that means that basically everybody is affected pretty much the same way. And I will say the income tax is incredibly progressive, so people at the high end pay that 56%. And when my wife retired, she took another job at in the department, but she went to half time. And I thought, well, you know, our income's going to be cut in half. It wasn't. It was only cut in a quarter because she dropped down into another income tax bracket.
Now, you were talking a little bit ago about those property taxes, which here in the United States, they're funding schools and they're funding roads and building infrastructure. How does Sweden handle that, Niamh?
Well, Sweden collects the money through those sales taxes. That brings in a large amount of money. Other taxes from the general revenue fund replace that property tax. And property tax is one of the more unfair taxes. When I was in Lodi having breakfast with my farmer friends, they said, you know, we pay tax on our retirement program. You don't pay any tax on it. And they were absolutely right.
How do you want people to think differently about taxes in the United States? We're looking at a legislature right now, a Republican-led legislature that wants to change the tax code, simplify the tax code, make other changes. What do you want Americans to be thinking about at this particular political juncture in this country?
Well, I think we're at a time of great change, and I think there are many opportunities. And what I'm trying to do as a writer is to communicate to people in a positive way how things are being done in Europe. We just see people grab a single statistic, 56% tax. Oh, my God! When the fact of the matter is it's much more interesting than that and much fairer, and it brings you stuff. So that's what I'm trying to do as a writer. Nationally, we certainly should be working on tax simplification, and everybody could agree to that no matter which side of the continuum they're on.
And we'll leave it there. Tom, thank you so much for coming into the studio and joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Talking there to Thomas Heberlein, a professor emeritus at UW-Madison. He divides his time between the United States and Sweden, and he's currently a teacher in Sweden, and he's at work on the book Falling in Love with Sweden, One Mistake at a Time. And don't forget, you can check out the article we've been discussing. It ran in Vox.com. It's Thomas's piece on taxes and why he loves paying taxes in Sweden, far prefers that despite the higher tax rate to paying taxes in the United States.